Stephen, give us like your story. I know you have like a pretty amazing testimony. I'd love to hear just like what your background is.
Yeah, you know, my background is pretty wild. You know, I just literally wrote a book that comes out in February with Zondervan. So my story is pretty crazy. And I never thought I would do something like that because it's the kind of thing. I wrote it in a coffee shop. And I think the whole time I was doing it, I was like, should I be in like a cabin in the woods with like a minister on hand? You know what I mean? Or a therapist. Right. My dad was like an evangelist, like a traveling evangelist. And so I grew up like in church camps and stuff. And I would see him get up, preach about Jesus. But behind closed doors, I'd watch him, you know, physically abuse my mom. And so that was traumatic. And so at a young age, I decided, you know what, if God's real, he's not good. And I don't want anything to do with this Jesus guy. And so I began down this pretty destructive path of addiction and rebellion. And 11 years old, it was smoking and drinking and marijuana, that kind of stuff. By the time I was 15, it was cocaine, pills, I'm selling drugs. By the time I was 17, I was a full-out crystal meth addict, and I did that for many years to come. And I was the guy that legitimately, this is not just a cute, like I'm not just saying this to get like a shock factor, but like I hated Jesus, I hated Christians, I hated everything about it. And I was the guy that legitimately would have cussed you out had you mentioned his name around me or tried to knock you out. You know, it was wild, man. I'm not, again, if you'd have met me, you would have pointed at me and said, man, if there's ever an enemy of the cross, it's this guy. And so that literally was my upbringing and my childhood and like my very long dark night of the soul kind of stuff. You know, it was pretty crazy.
So were you always involved in as a musician? Like, when did you start singing?
My parents had asked me to sing once, like as a little kid, even in like these church camp stuff. But I didn't do anything until like I was probably around 13 years old. I started playing bass and singing. And so I did that for throughout my entire teens, man. Music was always there. You know, my last name literally means son of the harpist. So it was kind of crazy. It was almost like I was like, this is something that's literally I've called you to do, and you're trying to make sense of it in all these broken ways, and you'll eventually get there, you know? It's very interesting. I think we all have like a deep thing in us that's this desire that without the Lord, it ends up coming out in all these broken, distorted ways, and we just catch ourselves being frustrated or jaded or bitter, you know what I mean? Until we start to understand like what it looks like with him to do it. Throughout all that, there were people praying for me, man, like legitimately praying for me to come to Jesus. I remember somebody came, they offered me this book called The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. Do you know the book? Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
And it's wild because Lee's a friend of mine now, which is crazy. You know, God really writes the best stories. But somebody offered me this book, and I found out some years later that this is crazy. My dad gave the book to someone who gave it to me, and I didn't know that, which is crazy. I had no idea, but I accepted this book, and it was like a blur because I told you how much I hated Jesus. So the fact that I accepted this book without cussing somebody out is probably the parting the Red Sea story, like moment in my testimony. But they give me this book. Fast forward, it's like a blur. I'm like, cool, whatever. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm in this room. I literally have drugs on the side table next to me. Nobody's playing, you know, soft pads on a Nord in the corner. It's like seemingly the most improbable place for somebody to come to Jesus. But I'm reading this book about Jesus. Don't even ask, okay, why or how, but it's what happened. And I'm reading this book and I just know God's in the room. I don't know how to explain it. Like, just know he's there. And we just begin to have this kind of like internal dialogue where I was like, I want to give you my, you know, I want to quit all this. I want to quit all this addiction, all this darkness, all this anger, all this ugh that I've known for so long. God, I want to. There's literally no way I can do it. This is all I've known for so long. I can't imagine being somebody else. And I just kind of remember this thought from the Lord. Like, I didn't audibly hear him, but I knew it wasn't me, right? It was like this thought. It was, Stephen, you won't do it. I'll do it. And I know now that that's kind of like Ephesians 2:8, right? You're saved by grace. This isn't something you can boast about, but it's a work of God. And there's something we can do. John 6:29 says the only work the Father asks of you is to believe. And when I thought that and I knew it was the Lord, I was like, okay, I agree. I believe. what you're saying to me. Like, I believed him. Like, I believe I'm breathing air right now. And gave my life to Jesus, literally quit everything. Like a year and a half later, I became a worship leader at a very hard up church. And the truth is, man, still to this day, and I tell people, by the way, the fact that I quit everything, don't ask me how, it's the Lord. And also don't be discouraged, because in the gospel, Jesus never healed anybody the same way twice. If it takes six times, 11 times, and you fall at his feet and you mean it, he's going to use your story. It's awesome. And that's what I've found to be true. But yeah, I mean, it was a whirlwind, and I'm still today like, oh my gosh, God's real. And I try to hold on to that moment so I don't get too caught up in the politics of church and like the industry and all the stuff and forget. Oh yeah.
When you were like, you know, totally going, you know, against as a teenager, like you were probably like, you know, going against what your dad was preaching and all that stuff. Although, you know, he was doing these other things. What were your parents saying? Were they like trying to like get you back on track, or were they trying to preach to you, or were they just kind of like, he's gone?
You know, you're going to have to read my book. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. No, it's all in there, but, okay, yeah, I mean, cool. At the end of the day, not really. I think my mom really was praying for me. I was a pretty crazy, broken, hard to talk to individual. If you've ever known anyone in a situation like that, then you know what I mean. It's kind of one of those things where you're just like, you got to go, God, you're going to have to do it. And fast forward, my dad, at this point in my story, by the way, when I was getting saved, my dad hadn't like touched my mom in years. I do not condone it. I wish she'd have divorced him, all that, whatever. But he hadn't at this point. And I actually knew the Lord was calling me to do probably the hardest thing I ever did, which was just go forgive my dad. And I actually went and forgave my father, which was crazy. It was not a magical moment. It was just super awkward. And I ran out the door. But, you know, the Lord ended up like kind of, you know, healing that thing a little bit as best he could. My dad ended up performing our wedding ceremony. He ended up baptizing my wife and I. Now he's been dead from cancer for 12 years. But I literally sat in the room. I was the only person in the room with him when he took his last breath, when he died. And I literally leaned in as he was getting ready, as he was struggling. Because if you've ever been in hospice with somebody battling cancer, you know, they're like kind of holding on. There's this weird thing going on there. And I just remember I was the only person in the room. And I just leaned in and I said, I forgive you. And I love you. And then my dad took his last breath. No joke. And so that whole thing, man, for me, it's all like stuck in my mind, in my heart, in who I am. And so everything I'm doing, bro, is rooted in this thing where like, oh my gosh, God is real. And there's literally nothing he can't restore and use. And it's crazy, man.
So that was how many years ago when you read that book and transformed?
Over 20 years ago.
So after that, you ended up getting a job at a church and you got married at some point right after that. Like, and how'd you get a job at a church a year after that?
Never underestimate just how hard up a pastor is for a worship leader that's any good. Ex-meth addict, we'll take you. Come on.
yeah, you're in.
So, I mean, let's be honest. That was that. I didn't take much for me to get in with these people. And it was interesting. I think at that time, I'd been like metal bands screaming my head off. But I knew God was real. So when this pastor slid me a list of songs I was allowed to play, by the way, at this point in my story, the coolest song on that list was I Can Only Imagine. Everything else was like hymns. And I was like, wow. But when you actually have encountered the Lord the way I did, I was just happy to sing these songs because I believe it's real. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. So the thought of it being cheesy or anything, honestly, at that point, didn't cross my mind.
How long were you on staff at the church?
That one, I was a worship leader in whole. I was at that one for about 4 years. And then I was at another one for 7 or 8 years. Yeah, I've been full-time songwriter, artist kind of thing now for ever since. And so it's been, you know, quite a few years. I've just been doing this full-time songwriting, still traveling from church to church, leading worship, and which is interesting. When you go and you go to all these different churches, you sometimes when you're at one place all the time, you just become part of that culture, and that's great. It's awesome. Just by going to lots of different places, you see this overarching theme of the bride connected, but you also see the same, the struggles that everybody struggles with. They're right. in a lot of the same places. And it's just, I don't know. It's like really opened up a lot of grace for me for just different places and different things. And it's been really cool.
When did you get into songwriting? When did that begin?
You know, I wrote this song years ago and I was already kind of into it, like younger, even I was trying to write metal songs, but when it really took shape as a worship guy, was I wrote this song called God That Saves that was part of this group called Iron Bell Music. And this guy, Jason Ingram, heard it and some people heard it. And it kind of just opened the doors and we're like, hey, and next thing you know, I'm writing with people who now are dear friends of mine. And it really was the Lord. Like I, at no point in my story did I call somebody up in Nashville and go, I want to write music, you know, blah, blah, blah. Was just literally like the Lord just made things happen that should not have happened that easily.
No, I know. It's a pretty amazing conversion story. Literally just like a couple of days ago, I was reading the story of Saul, you know, going, he hated Christians, walking down and then going down the road, blinded by God. And then God ends up using him, you know, and all the Christians were afraid of him for a little bit. And somebody had to like bring them to the other believers and be like, no, no, no. Like, here's the story. Here's what happened. He was blinded. And then he met this guy named Ananias. And
even then it takes time. You know, it took time. And I think for some people, it takes time. And I'd love to tell you that all the people I went to that didn't know Jesus yet, they all were like, yeah, we believe too. Let's do it. They all disappeared. And some of them later got saved. Most of them OD'd. Most of them are in prison. It is sad, but it's also not surprising. It's a narrow way. Only so many will actually choose it.
Faith is such a gift. Like, I'm often just overwhelmed by, wow, I am just grateful that my eyes have been opened. Like, thank you, God.
Yeah. What you just said could get washed over real quick. Like, faith is a gift. Somebody goes, oh, yeah, okay, Nick. Like, no, think about the fact that you believe. The fact that you believe is one of the greatest things in your life. Like, it's crazy.
What was it like for you? Because you knew about faith. And then you like turned away from it, like against it, basically. Hated Christians, I think is what the word you used. Like what I'm wondering is like, is there anything you saw from being in that seat that actually maybe is like, okay, that's a learning lesson for those of us who are believers.
Yeah, I think obviously for me, it's hypocrisy and like just not seeing authenticity. And I mean, it's directly connected to a trauma, right, from my childhood with my dad and my mom and all that stuff. It's directly connected to that. But at the core of that was these people don't mean it, you know? It's like who you are when nobody's watching is the most important you. And I'm not saying that you has to be this perfectly holy person that never makes a mistake. But you just be honest about it, you know what I mean? And because it matters.
When did you start actually recording your own music? I know that you were like you're doing social media stuff, like you were getting, you know, a lot of songs on there. Did you start recording your own music before or after that?
Oh man, I was recording music in an apartment in my teens with like when they had the free 8-track demo of Pro Tools. Do you remember that? You might remember. Yeah. I don't know. Was this like free 8-track demo. And so I was like, that blew my mind. I'd never done it before. So I was trying to figure it out then. I was terrible at it. And then, you know, of course, you know, the first Iron Bell record we did it with Nathan Knuckles, who is, you know, did all the early Passion stuff and Matt Redman stuff. And I just noticed early on, I was always like, hey, open up that channel strip and let me take a picture of everything you did. And like, tell me, you know, why'd you do that? And why'd you do this? And I had just enough people tell me I have good instincts to get myself in trouble. So I,
and right.
you know, as a musician now and not to sound unspiritual about it, but as a small business owner, I guess is what you would say, you know, which doesn't sound romantic, but it's true. You are going, should I spend that much money on something that when I could do this? And most people don't care that I didn't do this or that, you know.
I was just talking to someone yesterday about how expensive it is to make music and how as an indie artist, it's almost impossible to recoup that. Like the amount of money it costs to record a song, the amount of money you can get from, you know, 1,000 streams on Spotify, the math doesn't work.
It just depends on how you do it. I mean, I honestly have found the average person is looking for authenticity in the worship space above and beyond. I mean, let's go back to the early House Fire stuff. Let's say that early House Fire stuff. A lot of people in the industry that I know would listen to that stuff and go, man, it's just terrible mix. like just terrible. Everybody loved it. Everyone who ever heard it loved it. And why was that? There was just an authenticity that was captured. And so I think you'll find that you can start at a lot of simple places. And if you start to build up some money, you still need to hold on to that authenticity factor.
You mentioned the old House Fires album. You know, one of my favorite albums, do you remember United Pursuit? And they had this album that came out called Live at the Banks House.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I re-listened to that a lot because it is so genuine. Like you said, it's just like raw. And you hear people singing so loud. It literally feels like you're standing there like in this living room.
My first big version of Come Jesus Come that I did that like people were like, oh my gosh, this is blowing up. You can hear people coughing in it and like, you know.
It's amazing.
It's like imperfect in every way. If I would have given that to a producer in Nashville, then it went, Steven, are you okay? What are you doing?
I love that. Well, and you've got some new music coming out too.
I mean, I am kind of annoying because I constantly put music out. And so to the industry, I might be like, okay, what are you doing? You know, I've realized that it's not about being the biggest thing ever. It's finding the people that are your people and just making music for the Lord. And that group of people keeps growing. And so I'm like, okay, I'll just keep making music. And it seems pretty fun. And so, yeah, we put My Right Now out at the beginning of October. And it was just kind of more of a collection of just songs I've written with people. It was a little bit more polished. And yeah, man, it was just super special, super fun.
That's a good place to be. And then you've got a Christmas song out. Do you like Christmas music?
I used to not like Christmas music, if I'm honest. As a worship leader, you were always like, okay, gosh, there's so many chords, there's so many things. Now, over the years, I have developed versions of the songs where I'm like, oh, man, I actually really love these songs. And so, yeah, now it's kind of like fun to come back and do them every year and like kind of just simplify them.
It's so funny because as a worship leader, I'm the same. I always decline all of the December requests at my church. I will not play in December because I do not want to play Christmas music. I'm just one of those weird worship leaders.
I have one event I'm doing in all of December, and I normally am gone all the time because of that reason. I am kind of like, I mean, I like to record them versions that I do and then just put them out.
This version of O Come Emmanuel, is it a version that like a church could apply or is this just like a really cool like?
Yeah, no, I think a church could do it if they wanted to. I've had a few people. I think it's both. There's a part of it that this is tricky. For the most part, I don't ever go, is this simple enough for a church to play? One of the things I did was because of the song is like the people of God, you know, crying out for the Messiah, I went and attached to the end of it this 5,000-year-old song, which is the Shema. I've been to Israel, and so I kind of done my research on it and like figured out how to do it right and not sound like some, you know, American just trying to do it. And but it's the you know, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one, love the Lord your God with all your, it's that. And so it was kind of fun to like, Israel's crying out for the return of the Messiah, all creation is, but you know, and then to add this prayer that they've been singing and praying for 5,000 years as a people to the end of it was fun. That was cool. I was like, oh, I love this. So
on this show, we talk a lot about just tips for worship leaders because you were on staff at a church for a while there, which is great. So you have some experience here. How do you get your team to improve their musicianship without burning them out? And what I mean by that is like you could keep doing rehearsals like crazy and totally burn them out. But also then how do you motivate them to actually like get better, you know, on their own? You know, when you've got like Dentist Steve who's volunteering play bass, how do you get Dentist Steve to actually up his bass game?
No, I get it. I'll say a couple of things to that. Like, this is really about your rotation, okay? Let's be honest. This is about you looking at your rotation going, I mean, you do care about these people and you want to get them involved, but you're looking at your rotation going, I want to use somebody else so this person doesn't get burned out. But if I use this other person, they're not as good as this person. And I think one of the biggest things is, how do you get this guy who's a dentist to get better? I don't know. Because does he really want to do it or is he just helping out? That's the real thing. And you, if it's somebody that really wants to, probably the biggest thing is giving them the time to be able to do it and understanding that they have a full-time job. They're not going to go home every day and just blah, 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 blah. But if you can give them things to work on in advance, great. And so one of the things I've found is we're not talking about mega churches here. We're not talking about churches with thousands and thousands and thousands of people coming because they're not having this problem as much. We're talking about the 90% of churches out there, which are the churches that are 200, 500, or 80 people. And they're like, what do we do? And I would say this, it is about the rotation, but it's also about not trying to, because I know the dread of, okay, Sunday, that was so great. Oh no, there's another one coming. And it's like, once you get this really great one, you feel like you have to top yourself every week, which I will just say right now is not, I don't believe that's from the Lord, because now you're operating out of a works-based, performance-based situation. And you're honestly teaching the people that go to your church that that's how it should be and to expect it. And then when you don't do it, that you're going to get a note. You're going to get a, oh, why didn't you do what you did? So you kind of have to change up what they expect. And this is the thing I always tell people, that they kind of look at me like a deer in headlights. Like they hate the idea because they never do it. Could you just do a minimum of one acoustic Sunday a month? This sounds so simple and so silly, but if you did one where you just picked the most singable songs ever, and you just got up with an acoustic and you told the church, you're leading worship with me today. We're doing this together. And you just, and by the way, people will remember that Sunday because everybody in the church will be singing. And now it'll probably end up being the Sunday they look forward to. And then you start to create this space to go, okay, this week's cool. I don't even need to do rehearsals. It's just me with the guitar, or it's just me with the piano. I don't have to worry about it. We have this whole week off to invest in these other people, to talk with them. I mean, because it's time. It's a time thing, bro. But a lot of people look at me and go, oh, everybody's going to, it's just not going to have the power or the bigness of what we normally do. And I would disagree.
I agree. They would be surprised if they tried it. It made me think about my old days. I grew up in the Vineyard church movement, so with the Vineyard music. And I'm thinking like way back, like early 90s, right? You know, there was no high tech. Like we had like stripped down band, and the worship songs were so simple. They were easy to sing. They were very congregational. And the thing that made worship so sweet was just that it was the congregation doing it together. It was not spectator at all. You could hear every voice in the congregation singing. It was a communal thing. And it was very special.
It feels super holy and like, I don't know, you know. And then you also want to say, what kind of songs are we doing? In those environments, I would, from a theological perspective, I would keep it all very vertical, like straight to him kind of stuff. If you can, it's okay to do like a goodness of God or something. But if you create this, we're just singing to him, giving him what he wants, simply, not dolled up, just genuine. I think people will go, oh man, this is great.
I love that. That is also, those are my favorite moments of worship. When I think back, like it's always those moments, vertical, communal singing. And yeah, you don't need a full band for that. You could literally just do that with an acoustic guitar. It's like the easiest planning in the world.
It's what I keep saying. I'm like, often as like leaders and stuff and people in anything, when you look at something that's getting crazy and out of hand, you're trying to figure it out. The question isn't, what do you add? The question is, what do you remove so that you can make it work? And that doesn't mean it's lesser. It can be really special.
Get rid of the tracks. It also gives your team
I didn't say a that. You need your loop community tracks for everything.
Yeah, no matter what. If it's just you on acoustic, you've got to.
Nobody's getting saved without a track rig.
Right. That's right. Literally get rid of the pads, get rid of the tracks, and do exactly what you just said. Literally just an acoustic guitar and pick simple songs. Churches would be amazed, I feel like, what that does.
You know, what's great about that is it really does take like the Lord showing up for it to work. So it's kind of like, okay, I like to be a part of things that if he doesn't show up, I look stupid. That lets me know maybe I shouldn't be doing it. You know what I mean? It's like, that's okay. You want those. You want that to happen so you know what's going on.
I remember times when I was on staff at a church where like maybe the power, like literally we'd be starting a service. We have a full band, production, everything. And the power like goes out. And literally you've got that awkward moment of like, okay, what do we do? You know, no one can hear, the lights are down. And what I remember one moment where I just like got down, I unplugged my guitar and I went and sat at the edge of the stage. And we just did literally acoustic worship with no microphone, no speakers, nothing. no lyrics, and it was awesome, man.
Yeah, I bet people go, man, remember that time this happened? People go to concerts and that happens, like a famous person like does a concert, the power goes out, and then they come out and they do this super intimate thing. People go, man, it was so cool. Nobody goes, oh, bummer, the power went out.
Steven, so if you were just sitting down over coffee with a worship leader, like what advice would you give them? Is there something that you would really want to impart to them?
I get asked this a lot. I really do, like, by a lot of people, if there's any like one bit of advice you would give me as a worship leader. And I think this probably surpasses a skill set, like rehearsals. It really does. And it's this: spend so much time just worshiping Jesus in, like, when nobody's watching. And this is tricky. Don't rehearse and prepare for Sunday. Don't hit record on voice memo because you got a cool idea. Literally just open your Bible and just sing to him. Just worship with him, and not for anyone to ever hear but him. And you spend so much time in that place that then when you get on a stage, it's now the overflow of who you are all the time when nobody's watching. And this is why I believe there are some worship leaders out there that you might hear them and go, they're not doing it right, or they're not as skilled, or they're not as, their voice isn't as good as others. But there's something about them where you're like, gosh, I'm just like drug into the presence of the Lord right now. And I believe it's that. I believe it's they spend a lot of time with him, and that shapes who they are on a stage. Because it's not now I'm on a stage, now I'm worshiping. No, there's a lot of people that do that, and it just doesn't, it's flat. You know what I mean? But that thing that's developed when nobody's watching, that's sincerely just for Jesus, then when you get on a stage, man, and you're playing these songs, there's something's different. And it's like you're actually able to do it authentically. Because you do see a lot of churches, and you see a lot of people doing all the right gestures, all the things they're supposed to do on a stage. They've been taught to do, and the way to say it, and the words to say in between songs. And those are fine, I guess. But what if it was just out of this place of just you sincerely spend time with Jesus, just loving him with no agenda, not because you're going to be on a stage, not because of anything else, just because it's real. That's the thing you cannot manufacture.
Wow. And people sense it in the congregation because they're being led by somebody who is taking them somewhere they've already been before. That's great advice, man. Well, Steven, I appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation with me and pour into worship leaders. And thanks for sharing your story, too. I can't wait to read this book. When does it come out?
That comes out February, I want to say the 10th, the first Tuesday of February.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Radically Restored. That's amazing. What a great story. I appreciate what you're doing, man. And I love your heart, man. All right, guys, great conversation. Write down in the comments, what's one piece of advice you would give another worship leader over a cup of coffee? Hit the subscribe and like buttons and stay tuned for future Worship Fuel shows.
Just for what it's worth, so you know, I do love the track rig, man. We use it.
Really?
If I do tracks, that's what we use. Oh, yeah. I was an early adopter. We love it. This was back in, like, when you guys literally first came out with it. So we got it before there was an on and off switch. I don't remember what it was. I think we were using, like, just some random set of, like, splitters and all kinds of different stuff to make it work. And it was just like, oh, my gosh, this is great. It was perfect. Lifesaver for us, for sure.